This is the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the WGN Skyline studio. And joining me on the phone is Mark Maxwell. Mark is the State House correspondent for the Nexstar TV stations here in Illinois, including WCIA-TV in Champaign and, yes, Chicago's very own WGN-TV. Mark, thanks so much for joining me this evening.
Rick, a pleasure to be back with you, and congrats on the new time slot. I don't know about you, but the coffee's still on for me, even at this late hour.
I think I could really use some coffee right now because this has been such a year, and it and there's always something. And when you look at what this city has been through, what it's going through, we're seeing how the suburbs are getting hit by looting. It just never ends. And I'm really having trouble dealing with it. I mean, it's like I said, when I walked over from the Thompson Center today over to the studio, that was really the first chance I had to see in person some of the damage that was caused by the looting here in downtown Chicago. And it just literally took my breath away. And what I was breathing in was sawdust from the guys putting up boards over the windows. I've been watching and following this nationally on TV, and one of the things that has troubled me a lot was the whole issue of journalists getting caught in the line of fire on these things. You had the Omar Jimenez, the CNN correspondent, Chicago-based correspondent for CNN, he and his crew were arrested on live TV. A young reporter, female reporter in Louisville, and you had law enforcement shooting rubber pellets at her and her cameraman. A Minneapolis Star Tribune reporter had a bullet was shot through his window because he was going through an intersection, even though he had been cleared because he was a member of the media. Obviously a lot of people on edge, a lot of tension, but I just kind of wanted your take on all this.
Yeah, Rick, it's interesting. I'll say I think a lot of us reporters have covered protests before. But I can say for me, I was in the middle of the downtown protests, some of the demonstration just last night. And tonight, we're covering it from Champaign. There's a series of looting happening even here. And some of the protests in the city of Springfield were more peaceful. But if you listen to it, it's a trying time. It's a difficult story to cover because you have the voices of people who, you know, if we listen to the quote from, you know, Dr. Martin Luther King, who said the protest is the voice of the unheard. There are a lot of people out there who really do want this outlet, whether it's being, you know, pent up during this time of the coronavirus closures. There's this extra frustration that's an added layer on top of the decades and centuries of, racial injustice that so many of these protesters speak about when they go to the streets. Many of them, in the indiscriminate nature of the looting, you know, that kind of violence or lawlessness, those actions are endorsed by, you know, next to no one.
Right.
But it does still seem like there's a way to listen to that sort of that scream and say, what is it that they're trying to say? And you know, there's a way to listen to that still. I think that, you know, as a political reporter, I don't advocate for any political cause one way or the other. But right. The one thing that I think if I can advocate for this, I could say that we do have an outlet for political disagreements. And we saw that last week in session, which is where our elected officials come together and they debate things and they put it all out there. And then they agree on some sort of way to move and then they leave and they go do something about it. There is a political process that I think maybe people have lost trust in, but if they, you know, put, if there's that renewed sense of saying, let's put this into something, is that there is a political process that can yield a result. And we've seen that happen in some ways.
Well, and that's why, you know, I always advocate for civic engagement and civic education. And it's not, I'm not saying what, you know, what party to join or that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But if you want to, you know, make a difference, you have to get involved. And obviously that starts with voting, and voting means things. Voting has consequences. Voting, you know, that's the first thing. But yes, there. I mean, we do have a process. I can understand, you know, the frustration of many of those nonviolent protesters that, you know, just wonder if it isn't more lip service over these decades. And you know, yes, change does not happen quickly. And we know that in Springfield, if anything. But I mean, and I think you hit it on the head, too, that I think the kind of a pent up I don't know what the right word is, but just people feeling pent up by the homebound nature of those executive orders from the governor. I mean, it almost seemed like, in some respects, a perfect storm kind of situation.
But there's also the question of where do we go from here?
Right.
You know, if in the eyes of and in the voices of some of these, you know, vandals or looters, you know, they may feel content to blow off some steam. But as we all try to recover from this and recognize and listen, moving forward, there's a real question that I think journalists are going to be on the front lines of understanding, you know, telling the stories of the storefront owner who has to pick up the shambles, not just of the glass shards that now litter the street outside of their storefront, but also, you know, file the insurance claims and then hope that there are enough customers to come back and keep their company alive in the next 3 months as they try to recover from this coronavirus. It's going to be difficult. And, you know, there's more reporting to do than ever. You know, it seems like we don't have enough cameras or enough recorders to take it all down and share it. But, you know, but there's some sort of therapy, I think, in listening to each other and understanding where we go from here and, you know, trying to, you know, do less harm and do more good.
Yeah, and I think the governor mentioned it today in the press conference, the issue of, you know, here are places that are getting looted that have been, for the most part, they've been the ones shut down for 10 weeks. They're just getting ready to at least start a soft, partial reopening. And what do they see? But windows shattered and their stock immediately gone. I mean, frustration with for these small business owners, some of these smaller retailers, and you know, we going into just the pandemic, we weren't sure how many of them were going to come back, and especially, you know, I'm sure you've talked to Sam Toya, I've talked to Sam Toya, Sam Toya's talked to everybody. But that was always my big fear, too, was, you know, with restaurants and those kinds of things. Well, a number of those got severely damaged in last night's violence. You know, I asked Representative Chris Welch if, you know, if we step back from this, is anything going to change when it comes to issues of inequality being dealt with in Springfield? And I don't know if you heard his response, but he actually questioned whether anything would change.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's easy to be cynical. I think that's kind of probably one of the main points that many of the demonstrators went to the streets to say, was that, okay, maybe we do have a political process, but it's not working for us right now, and it's certainly not working fast enough. And that seems to be one of the biggest motivating factors, is that there's a discontent, there's a frustration at the system we have. But that, you know, that conversation is going to continue in these next, you know, few weeks and months. I also heard your questions to the governor or to the mayor earlier at the press conference today, Rick, and you were asking, you know, do we know yet who might be behind any of, you know, organizing some of these protests? And it, you know, I think there is a history throughout, you know, our nation for sure, of some political, and this is a cynical thought, but there are some political groups or organizations that see opportunity,
sure,
in a movement that mobilizes like this, and that sees the chaos as a chance to sort of press our politics in a certain direction. And who knows, you know, as we learn more about who might be organizing some of these things, what that might tell us about what's at play on the political side of it. But certainly this is a moment that's going to, you know, ring out in the ears of voters all the way to November, as this is not, it just doesn't feel like any other ordinary protest. It feels certainly different.
No, it really, and that's the thing, is maybe, you know, obviously we're talking in the immediacy of things, and maybe, but maybe it's different when you step back, but I'm not sure. I really don't. This has really been something else. We're speaking with Mark Maxwell. He's State House correspondent for the Nexstar stations in Illinois, including WCIA TV, Channel 3 in Champaign, and Chicago's very own Channel 9 WGN. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. It's 7:46 on this Sunday evening in Chicago. I'm Rick Pearson. This is your Sunday Spin. And joining me on the phone is Mark Maxwell. He is the State House correspondent for the Nexstar TV stations in Illinois. And Mark, I have a call from Ron, who always has a good question. Ron, thanks for calling the Sunday Spin.
Yes. You know, thank you, Rick, and to your guests. You know, to your guests, I've been reading over and over, actually for the last 6 months, Dr. King's last book, Where Do We Go From Here? Chaos or Community? So to me, it seemed like the answer has been answered. We are in total chaos, and your guests made reference, you know, to him, but I just... You want to ask him, where is any kind of optimism? Because all of the things, the conditions that he was addressing in 1968 still exist now. And I Rick, you know, I usually try to have a good question, but I really just want to make a comment. But I hear people quoting Dr. King, but do they really pitch it to some of the solutions that he talked about? So I just want to ask him, where is it? Because after 1968, and we are still here, total chaos. So that's it. And thanks as always, Rick. This is some very tough time, but thanks for letting me ask that question.
Appreciate sure, Ron. Thank you very much. You know, and I think Ron does make a point. You know, how far has civil rights really progressed in since Dr. King's assassination in 68? And you know why are we fighting the same fights? I guess is what it comes down to. And you know this kind of you know I know it's not necessarily a fair comparison, but it's kind of like the issue of shooting incidents at schools, and how everybody looks for something to be that catalyst that moves something. And you know, nothing's changed much on that score at all. And mm-hmm. I mean, so yeah, I mean the frustration obviously is evident. And yeah, we do have a political process, and you were front row and center to see that in the special pandemic session of the Illinois legislature, which I mentioned this to Chris Welch earlier, that I, even though, you know, I was far away watching it on my laptop, I still could kind of sense that there was a more of a dedication to purpose of getting in, getting the job done, and getting out than what you'd normally find among the General Assembly.
Well, some of the lawmakers might tell you that dedication to purpose was due in part to the absence of reporters and lobbyists and the public. They were sort of isolated from a lot of the people that would normally bend their ear or ask for a favor or ask for a soundbite. And so they were able to sort of push through or focus on a lot of, you know, 3 or 4 months of work in about 4 days and took a lot of votes. But, you know, certainly that has its downside. You know, the public input is certainly a big part of the legislative process.
Yeah, and that's what I thought was kind of a frustrating situation, was how, you know, the access to legislators that are deciding policy is key for the media. We're kind of the representatives of the public asking the representatives that the public elected what's going on, and that seemed to be kind of a critical element. And, you know, quite frankly, that's we've seen that somewhat the case with the way we've been forced to kind of pool these things for the governor's press conferences.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Ron's question still is sort of lingering with me. He was asking about, you know, where is the progress? And, you know, in listening to a lot of the elected officials, I can almost hear their voices in my head now. If we were to interview them and say, where is the progress? They'd point to some of the things they got done in the last 2 years in Springfield. I think Dr. King's message toward the end of his years was about more of the economic justice and the fact that he felt so many people of color were left out of the economic equation in our country. And the cannabis legislation that got passed promised a new day in that chapter. Now, those promises haven't all quite come in yet. But, you know, Springfield has done some work to try and include more avenues, in reducing crimes for some of those things, but also for creating new business opportunities and for new investment. I think our elected officials today would tell you that progress does come. And in moments like this, it's easy to look back and say, it's dark right now. But there has been action and effort to try and address some of these things. And I don't know. I guess Ron asked a really good question, and it kind of stuck with me there. But
certainly on the criminal justice front, we're seeing a whole different era. And one of the things I always cite about that, though, is that's kind of a convergence of two different ideologies, often ideologies of, you know, social justice advocates and Democrats on one side and conservative Republicans who are just kind of, why are we paying for these costs? Why are we paying that heavy cost for incarceration when for people that don't necessarily need to be incarcerated? I mean, it's kind of a meeting of the minds there that has actually helped fuel a lot of progress on that front.
But it seems that some of the issues that are being, you know, forefront right now are less about legislative, I guess, and more about just the pursuit of justice. The prosecutor, the police officer, the citizen, those interactions happen, you know, outside of any committee hall or outside of any kind of legislative body. I mean, these are where government meets the individual directly. And that conversation, certainly, I think it's been interesting to listen to some police who step up and say they were sickened by what they saw in Minnesota. And, you wonder how this moment changes their, you know, their psyche or their practice or what kind of behavior might be altered moving forward. But this does feel like a moment where, it's not easily forgettable.
No. And, you know, the issue is still, I mean, and as I mentioned to Representative Welch, you know, you could talk about different forms of training, efforts to try to always get trust with your community. But at the same time, you know, if a bad cop is a bad cop, it's not, training isn't going to matter. Go ahead.
Isn't that where, a good police chief comes in and talks about leadership and culture and where, you know, do we believe that a community of police officers can police themselves? Do we believe that there's a way to, you know, change that culture from the inside out? I mean, that's always been the question of government, too, is this whole experiment of self-governance. Can we set up rules and practices that change the arc of our own, you know, behavior as a community together? That is incumbent on police together in their departments across the state, across the country, to improve the way they, you know, interact with citizens. I think that's kind of the whole goal. I don't know if there's what legislative fix there might be, but a leadership fix certainly could. I think is going to be a part of the discussion increasingly from our elected officials.
And and quite a welcome to Chicago's new police superintendent too. I mean, what a way to really kind of get a head start on the job. I was going back to Springfield, and I was actually surprised. And again, you were kind of more boots on the a lot more boots on the ground than I was. I was actually kind of surprised that the city casino legislation got through as easily as it did, just knowing the history of gaming legislation in Springfield and watching it kind of tip and fall over as everybody attaches something on a attaches a new ornament to the branches.
Yeah, House Democrat Mike Zaleski was talking to me about this too. He's been big on gaming, and he actually made the comment to me in a phone call earlier this week. He didn't think it would have been done if it wasn't in that isolated situation where lawmakers weren't being bothered. He thought that that was one of the reasons why, if there were more, I mean, imagine the pressure from an army of lobbyists who wanted to come down and, you know, sink their teeth into this thing. But one of the other reasons why this bill may have passed is because 98% of the heaviest lifting really already got done in the last gaming bill. So they were really on the two-yard line with the Chicago casino. They just had to figure out how to split up the tax rates. There wasn't really a massive expansion of gaming in the state in this bill. That was done last session. So the argument was already made that the capital infrastructure bill that's going to, you know, rebuild Illinois in Governor Pritzker's plan is going to be funded in no small part by many of the revenues and taxes collected at the Chicago casino. So they had already started putting shovels in the ground. Now they said, look, we got to pay for it.
Well,
so, you know, there was some support from Republicans because of that reason. They wanted to see projects in their districts funded.
No, it's actually a very good point. Is because of the antiseptic nature of the legislature that it couldn't get necessarily too overweight and fall down on its own weight. I hadn't thought of that, but that's a very good point, because we all, like I said, we've all seen these things crash and burn before. I was curious about the issue of remote voting and how that that fell down in the House. And I was actually kind of surprised over some of the criticism, given, you know, we're dealing with a virus that nobody still knows that much about, and health and safety concerns, versus the, you know, some lawmakers who said, well, they met when there was the Spanish flu in 1918. Mm-hmm. But, you know, my comeback is, well, we didn't have Zoom. We didn't have the internet. I'm sure, you know, they could have maybe done telegraph at that point, but still, I mean, things are a lot different then, and I think we're more health conscious too.
Yeah, there's an argument to be made both ways. I mean, you do have the benefit of technology, but I think that even you and I would have a more personal conversation in person. And the way I look at it was, if they voted on that remote voting bill on day one, when they first got to Springfield, I think it probably passes. But over the course of those three, and then the fourth day, when they had that overtime day, lawmakers themselves remembered, oh yeah, we can get along more talking face-to-face. Senator Dale Ryder, a Republican from Mattoon, who's retiring after, I think, 23 years in the legislature, told me that to be an effective lawmaker from downstate and represent my views to elected officials in Chicago, I have to sometimes get in their face. And so I wear a mask so I can be around them. And, you know, he said he wasn't tested and all that, but he wanted to show that respect and say, look, I know we've got the coronavirus out here, but I still have to make my point in person. And there are those legislative, you know, tools that lawmakers use to persuade and all that. And some of those abilities are limited over Zoom or over the phone. And so over time, over those 3 or 4 days, you saw lawmakers remember, you know what, a lot of this work really is done better in person. And I think you saw that sort of opinion shift over the course of their 4 days in Springfield.
Yeah, I do agree too I thought that would be like a first day kind of no-brainer type of situation, but just an interesting session. I just hope we can move the legislative process back to quote normal sometime soon, hopefully for the November veto session. Mark Maxwell, state house correspondent for the Nexstar stations, including WCIA TV Channel 3 in Champaign, WGN TV. Thank you so much for joining me this evening.
Rick, it was a pleasure. Thanks for having me.